He was apparently not satisfied with the thunderous noise he was making because he began to use both hands, bringing them down simultaneously with sickening force on the wood while he glared wildly.
"Harriet!"
he shouted.
"There is just one thing I want to know from you. Do you want this bloody work, or don't you? Just say the word, and I'll give it to another practice, and then maybe we'll both be able to have a quiet life."
"Please, Mr. Harcourt, I give you my word. We do want the work very much." And I meant it with all my heart. The big man slumped back in his chair and regarded me for a few moments in silence. Then he glanced at his wristwatch. 12:10, he murmured. "Just time to have a beer at the Red Lion before lunch." In the pub lounge, he took a long pull at his glass, placed it carefully on the table in front of him, then turned to me with a touch of weariness. "You know, Harriet, I do wish you'd stop doing this sort of thing. It takes it out of me." I believed him. His face had lost a little of its colour, and his hand trembled slightly as he raised his glass again. "I'm truly sorry, Mr. Harcourt. I don't know how it happened. I did try to get it right this time, and I'll do my best to avoid troubling you in future." He nodded a few times, then clapped me on the shoulder. "Good. Good. Let's just have one more." He moved over to the bar, brought back the drinks, then fished out a brown paper parcel from his pocket. "Little wedding present, Harriet. Understand you're getting married soon. This is from my missus and me, with our best wishes." I didn't know what to say. I fumbled the wrapping away and uncovered a small, square barometer. Shame engulfed me as I muttered a few words of thanks. This man was the head of the ministry in the area, while I was the newest and lowest of his minions. Not only that, but I was pretty sure I caused him more trouble than all the others put together. I was like a hair shirt to him. There was no earthly reason why he should give me a barometer. This last experience deepened my dread of form-filling to the extent that I hoped it would be a long time before I encountered another tuberculous animal, but fate decreed that I had some concentrated days of clinical inspections, and it was with a feeling of inevitability that I surveyed Mr. Moberly's Ayrshire cow. It was the soft cough which made me stop and look at her more closely, and as I studied her, my spirits sank. This was another one. The skin stretched tightly over the bony frame, the slightly accelerated respirations, and that deep, careful cough. Mercifully, you don't see cows like that now, but in those days they were all too common. I moved along her side and examined the wall in front of her. The telltale blobs of sputum were clearly visible on the rough stones, and I quickly lifted the sample and smeared it on a glass slide. Back at the surgery, I stained the smear by Zeal Nielsen's method, and pushed the slide under the microscope. The red clumps of tubercle bacilli lay among the scattered cells, tiny, iridescent, and deadly. I hadn't really needed the grim proof, but it was there. Mr. Moberly was not amused when I told him next morning the animal would have to be slaughtered. "Its nobbert got a bit of a chill," he grunted. The farmers were never pleased when one of their milk producers was removed by a petty bureaucrat like me. "But I suppose it's no use arguing." "I assure you, Mr. Moberly, there's no doubt about it. I examined that sample last night, and..." "Oh, never mind about that." The farmer waved an impatient hand. "If bloody government says my cow's got to go, she's got to go, but I get compensation, don't I?"
"Yes, you do."
"How much?" I thought rapidly. The rule stated that the animal be valued as if it were out for sale in the open market in its present condition. The minimum was £5, and there was no doubt that this emaciated cow came into that category. "The statutory value is £5, I said.
"Shit,"
replied Mr. Moberly. "We can appoint a valuer if you don't agree." "Oh, well, let's get job over with." He was clearly disgusted, and I thought it imprudent to tell him that he would only get a proportion of the £5, depending on the post-mortem. "Very well," I said. "I'll tell Jeff Mallett to collect her as soon as possible." The fact that I was unpopular with Mr. Moberly didn't worry me as much as the prospect of dealing with the dreaded forms. The very thought of sending another batch winging hopefully on its way to Charles Harcourt brought me out in a sweat. Then I had a flash of inspiration. Such things don't often happen to me, but this struck me as brilliant. I wouldn't send off the forms till I'd had them vetted by Kitty Pattison. I couldn't wait to get the plan underway. Almost gleefully, I laid the papers out in a long row, signed them, and laid them by their envelopes ready for their varied journeys. Then I phoned the ministry office. Kitty was patient and kind. I'm sure she realized that I did my work conscientiously, but that I was a clerical numbskull, and she sympathized. When I'd finished going through the list, she congratulated me. "Well done, Mr. Elliot. You've got them right this time. All you need now is the Nuckerman signature and your post-mortem report, and you're home and dry." "Bless you, Kitty," I said. "You've made my day." And she had. The airy sensation of relief was tremendous. The knowledge that there would be no comeback from Charles this time was like the sun bursting through dark clouds. I felt like singing as I went round to Malik's yard and arranged with him to pick up the cow. "Have her ready for me to inspect tomorrow, Jeff," I said, and went on my way with a light heart.